everybody. This is Chris.
And Kathy.
We wanted to take a minute to thank you all for tuning in. We appreciate every listener and are grateful for this platform.
Please help us share our vision by subscribing to our show through your favorite streaming app. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Petability Podcast.
Check out our ever-growing list of affiliates and sponsors. Simply go to the show notes for information and links.
And be sure to use our promo code PETPOD22, that's PETPOD22, on checkout to receive your discount from our affiliates. And now here's a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Alon Landa, CEO of MedcoVet, and I'm a proud sponsor of Petability. We decided to partner with Chris and Kathy because, like them, we want to empower all pet owners who are trying to do the most for their pets. At MedcoVet, we specialize in advanced home laser therapy for pets. Laser therapy is a safe and effective treatment for common conditions like arthritis and wounds, and it relieves pain for most conditions caused by inflammation. With MedcoVet, pet owners can perform this treatment at home while receiving support from experienced clinicians. If you think your pet would benefit from healing at home, visit MedcoVet.com, and one of our clinical experts will work with you to determine if home laser therapy is the right fit for you and your pet. Tell them Petability sent you.
Welcome to Petability. I'm your host, Kathy Simons.
And I'm your host, Chris Cranston. Our podcast provides interviews and information to help your pets live their best lives. Good afternoon, Kathy. How are you on this hot summer day?
Oh, gosh, Chris. It is so hot here. It's 97 degrees here in Massachusetts. What's going on there in rural Iowa?
Yeah, I'm visiting my mom in the Midwest. Same. Very hot, very humid. I'm wilting. But fortunately, she has very good air conditioning. So that's good.
That's good news. Good news for everyone. Hey, who do we have for today on our show, Chris? What's going on?
Again, we are so fortunate to have another esteemed veterinary specialist as a guest today. Her name is Dr. Michelle Powers. She has an alphabet soup of letters behind her name, indicating all of her wonderful credentials. Mm-hmm. Two of the very most important are that she is both a diplomat of the American College of Surgeons, as well as the American College of Veterinary Sports Medicine and Rehabilitation.
She's one of our people. Yes. She's one of us.
Yes. And she's certified. She's certified as a canine rehabilitation therapist. So
Yeah.
So we're especially excited to have her talking about the topic that we are today, which is canine hip dysplasia, because get this, Kathy, not only did she study all this stuff and, you know, get all these credentials, but after she earned her veterinary degree, her DVM from Ross University in 1998, she then went on to complete multiple internships and conducted research as a Penn Hip postdoc fellow at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine.
Exciting.
It is exciting. Yeah. And we're going to explain a little bit during our interview about what this means. Penn Hip is specifically related to our topic today. So she is definitely an expert.
Yeah. And it's so important, I think, to talk about this because there are so many dogs out there that have hip dysplasia. There are so many dogs out there living with hip dysplasia. I think that maybe there's even might even be a little bit of a misconception that you only see large dogs with hip dysplasia, but that's not true. Any breed of dog can get canine hip dysplasia. So it's a very worthy topic.
Yes. And I think too that, you know, when I first got into this field, that was a term that a lot of people were familiar with. You know, whenever their dog was limping or lame or uncomfortable in their hind end, you know, they're like, oh, I think my dog might have hip dysplasia. Mm-hmm. And so it is something that is common that people are somewhat familiar with, but we're hoping to make you even more familiar. I wanted to just go on and tell another unique thing about Michelle before we welcome her here. So this, I think, makes her very unique because she gained the rank of major in the U.S. Army Veterinary Corps.
Wow.
And valuable experience caring for working dogs of the military, Border Patrol, and TSA.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Thank you, Dr. Powers. Thank you.
I know.
That is really cool.
Yeah. So through that experience with the military, she learned to enjoy orthopedic procedures such as arthroscopy, TPLOs. We had a show on TPLOs with our friend, Dr. Marianne Nieves recently, and fracture repair, and also specific soft tissue surgeries related to oncology, cardiothoracic surgeries, and reconstructive surgery. So that's pretty cool. Yeah. So here we go. Welcome, Dr. Michelle Powers.
Welcome, Dr. Powers.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we're really happy to have you on our show today. We've been talking about you know, the hip dysplasia for quite some time, Chris and I, about having a show about it, because we see so many patients in our private practice that have hip dysplasia. So I think this is going to be very informative for our listeners. So why don't we jump right in with talking about, or you explaining, what is hip dysplasia, and maybe we can discuss the anatomy a little bit of that.
Sure, that sounds great. You know, as a veterinarian, there are certain things that when a new client comes in or gets a young dog, they hear this word hip dysplasia, and sometimes they're scared to death of it. They think it's a, you know, life threatening, and my dog isn't going to live for a long time and do well. And no, it's not an ideal thing, but they can, with certain, you know, the multimodal approach, do well. I mean, hip dysplasia, the word dysplasia itself just means abnormal growth. And if you think of the hip as the hip joint as a ball and socket, so the socket is the part that's on the pelvis. And then the ball portion is what's on the femur or the thigh bone. And an easy way to think of that is like a ball at the end of a hockey stick, and the blade is the neck, and then the femur or thigh bone is the rest of the stick going down. And what we know with hip dysplasia is that there is a genetic component to it. Humans can get it. It's basically a laxity or a looseness of the hip joint, so that the ball is kind of either really out of the joint completely, or what we call subluxated, or it's halfway in or some percentage in, and it's kind of bouncing around. And the cartilage that's on the ball and the cartilage that's on the cup portion, they don't like to be bouncing around each other, and it damages that. And the end result of hip dysplasia is a dog developing arthritis, or another word, degenerative joint disease of that joint. And that's what causes, you know, the discomfort, is the arthritis and the secondary changes to like all of us who have arthritis, where you compensate. And so your hip flexors become tight, and you know, you don't have as much extension, you lose flexibility and everything like that that goes along with it. So that's kind of the basics of what hip dysplasia is. But there are things that we can do, whether what we call medical or conservative treatment versus surgical treatment, to help these dogs be more comfortable. We can't fix it or cure it. If someone could cure arthritis, they would be, I think, one of the richest people in the world.
Right.
And so that's important. There are things, I mean, genetics and proper breeding and evaluation of dogs is important. You know, the Seeing Eye Foundation, they have a lot of the breeds that have been known to have hip dysplasia, and with what they call breeding value. So knowing, you know, what that dog has, knowing the relatives, what, you know, how their hips were, instead of being, you know, having 50% of their population of dogs having hip dysplasia, you know, they're under about 10%, which is amazing. So it can be done. It's just a matter of choosing to be like, no, this isn't the appropriate dog to, you know, to breed.
So let me interject here. So am I clear in understanding that hip dysplasia, in its strict term, is just, you said, like an abnormal growth of the hip? So it is something that a dog is born with. There's nothing that the owner, once they have the dog, can do. They're just managing the situation that they have presented to them.
So basically, yes, it's what we call, it's a polygenetic trait. So that means, yes, you're born with it. There isn't going to be anything that an owner can then, you know, say, oh, I give this pill or I do this exercise and it isn't going to progress. So you have an abnormal development of the hip. What also affects it is when we say it's polygenetic is that there are environmental factors such as body weight that can make the hip dysplasia worse or be more clinical in that mm-hmm. sense.
Right. Is that right. Yep. Yep.
Understand with that. Yeah.
Exactly.
I think they did a study not that long ago about dogs that were overweight and had hip dysplasia, and they found during the study that dogs that lost the weight had quite a significant reduction in pain of their hips, if I'm not mistaken. I'll see if I can find that.
Yeah, there are a lot of studies that have looked at body weight, and we know that it is beneficial. The big one that I was part of when I was at UPenn with Dr. Gail Smith, who's basically the founder of Penn Hip, was the Purina Lifelong study, where they looked at a cohort of Labrador retrievers. So what that means is they took 48 Labrador retrievers that were, you know, that were related, divided them into two groups, and based on, and I'm not a geneticist, but, you know, based on the predictive value, they should have had X number of dogs be dysplastic, you know? And what they found, the study lasted for 14 years. And so one group of dogs were kept, like a nice lean body weight, and compared to their litter mate, the other ones got to become fat. And the leaner dogs lived on average 2 years longer, wow, had less clinical signs of osteoarthritis as they got older. And almost about 2 years later, they may have required, you know, like a anti-inflammatory for the discomfort of the arthritis. So body weight is a huge, huge factor in any arthritis, but I would, you know, to reduce the clinical signs that they see. And there's been a lot of studies that have shown that, but the Purina one was just amazing of what they did. You know, they had the same caretaker for the 14 years, and it was just an amazing study that they got a lot of information on.
Great. We can post that, Chris. We can find that and post it up so people can
absolutely
take a look.
Yeah. I remember learning about that, and it was just such an aha. You know, it makes sense, but we want proof in this stuff. And the other thing that, you know, it was 14 years. I mean, rarely do we have studies that are so longitudinal, you know, where you're following, the same dog from essentially birth to the end of their life. So, pretty cool.
Yeah, that doesn't happen. It's very hard in veterinary medicine to get, you know, good studies. And so that's why this was just a phenomenal effort, you know, with Purina doing that and the amount of information they got from these dogs. And they were so well taken care of, you know, it was just amazing. But the body weight and living longer, you know, as an orthopedic surgeon, too, I tell people, and you know, my technicians would joke around like, oh, Dr. Powers, you know, she's going to come in. She's really tough on the body weight, even if it's like 2 pounds, you know, because depending on the size of the dog, that could be 10% of their body weight. Mm-hmm. I go, never mind all the arthritis benefits. Your dog can live about 2 years longer. And let's face it, dogs don't live long enough. They're, you know, there are babies and we want them to live as long as they can. But, so keep your dog lean. Yep. You know, when I tell people, or I go, if someone tells you that your dog is thin, then I'll say he's probably perfect. And you can just tell him, thank you. My dog's going to live 2 years longer because he's this body weight. This way, you can have a cup of lettuce and you can have a cup of chocolate. It's the amount of calories that the dog is taking in. And it's just like anything. If you restrict the calories, they'll stay thin.
Yep.
And trust me, my dogs, when I go to McDonald's, they split a cheeseburger with me. So it's not like they don't get anything that, you know, human food.
So how do you diagnose a dog with hip dysplasia? I mean, when dogs come into our clinic that are sort of lame or painful in their hind end. And I also sometimes take into consideration the breed. You know, sometimes I see German Shepherds and I go, in my back of my mind, I go, maybe this dog is dysplastic. But how do we confirm that? How does the veterinarian confirm the diagnosis of hip dysplasia in the dog?
So it's based on one, you know, the history. There's a common commonality of the history that the dog may have difficulty when it's getting up. If it's exercised a lot, you know, a little bit more stiffness, and that they usually may walk out of. They tend to what we call bunny hop. So if you look at like a shepherd, especially, they have those nice long legs, ideally, and they should stride out almost like a horse, you know, in a gallop. And when they bunny hop, the back legs tend to stay together and they're pushing off with both legs. They'll also maybe have difficulty getting into the car or jumping up onto furniture. And those are kind of the classic, you know, signs that owners will say, oh, you know, has a hard time going up the stairs or doesn't run like my other dog. And then on physical exam findings, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. And the biggest thing is when you're looking at hips, you have to make sure, because back disease, hip disease, and knee disease, they can all be very similar in those clinical signs. The dog doesn't want to jump up on things or they bunny hop. So differentiating, is it back pain, hip pain, or knee pain, is important as a veterinarian. But a lot of times the muscling may be a little bit, they seem more bigger in the front, you know, barrel chested because they're throwing their weight forward. They don't like to extend their hips out as much, or also to abduct, or, you know, to lift their leg up and out because those hip flexors have become very, very tight. There are some dogs that you'll actually hear a clicking or a clunking sound. And on physical exam, when we put them on their side, we can sometimes get that hip to literally luxate over out of the joint because it's the laxity or that looseness of a hip that is like the number one risk factor. And so if you have loose hips, you're going to be able to manipulate those pretty easily. But then the definitive kind of diagnosis, how we do it, is based on radiographs. And with the radiographs, you kind of have, if you're looking to evaluate the hips, there's kind of basically two venues to look at them. The way that is most commonly done and kind of your standard just to look at hips for arthritis and you know, how the pelvis looks is what we call a hip extended ventral dorsal, meaning the dog is on their back and you're extending their hips out. So imagine us lying on the table with our arms over our head and our feet, you know, down at the other end of the table. And with that, and that's what the OFA will use, and that's the Orthopedic Foundation for Animal. They use that to evaluate how well the hip, so that ball and socket, how well that ball is sitting in the socket. And with these OFA type films, or if that's the place you're going to submit your radiographs to be evaluated, they will look at the hip for any bony changes that, you know, arthritis has already started, or if they're subluxated. So again, that's like the percentage of how much they think the hip is sitting in. And the OFA will grade them on a, if they feel they're normal, are they basically fair, good, or excellent? There is a category of borderline. And then if there are arthritic changes or they're very subluxated, then the other end of the spectrum would be, you know, mild, moderate, severe hip dysplasia. Okay. So that's the OFA version. The other one is the Penn Hip Improvement Program that was founded out of the University of Pennsylvania with Dr. Gail Smith. And that one is a much more sensitive test in the sense of, as I mentioned before, the big risk factor, right? So one of the risk factors that we feel is the biggest is what we call laxity. And there's what we call passive laxity and functional laxity. So when the dog is, let's say, under anesthesia or sedated and we're moving the hip around, that's the passive laxity. The dog just standing, walking, running is the functional laxity because there's the muscle that are help keeping, you know, holding the hips in. The way the Penn Hip is done is that there's three x-rays that are taken. The dog must be, you know, sedated. So we don't want their muscling or them going, why am I on my back? And you're, you know, moving my hips around. And that can cause them to be tense, which would make the hips look better with that. And so with Penn Hip, you take that view, that hip extended view, which the OFA uses, and you look to see, is there any overt bony changes? Is there any changes of arthritis that are present? How well the hip is seated in? And then the bread and butter view is what we call the distraction view, where we move the hips while they're still on their back to more of a standing angle. And we have this thing that's called the distractor that kind of is like the thigh master in a way. And basically, if you push on that distractor, it will cause the hips to subluxate, not detrimental, but it will show how much laxity are in those hips. And the radiographs for Penn Hip have to be submitted to the organization Penn Hip, and they will get officially read out, and you get a score that's basically 0 to 1. One meaning, you know, the hips aren't, the head isn't even in the joint. It's really luxated out. And the other is like, if you have a 0.5 distraction index, the easiest way to think about that is that 50% of that head is sitting in the joint or out of the joint. The tighter your hips are, the smaller that number will be. So dogs that have really tight hips have distraction indexes under 0.3. That means only 30% of that hip is luxating out. And so we see a lot of the, you know, the sight hounds, the greyhounds, the borzoids, which rarely ever get hip dysplasia, are really have tight hips, and they're under that 0.3. So there's two different ways to read them out. And there definitely is a difference in sensitivity between the two. The Penn Hip is definitely more sensitive, and that's what the Seeing Eye Foundation uses, the military, along with those reading values, used to really select for dogs that, you know, trying to get rid of hip dysplasia, where the OFA method is only one view. Technically, you don't have to be sedated. And the age is different too. You have to wait till 2 years of age to get your kind of permanent readout, whereas Penn Hip you can do as early as 16 weeks of age. Wow. Which is important if you have a working dog, right? Or the seeing eye. That's one of the reasons they use it, because are you going to start to invest in the dog if the hips are loose? So like the Penn working dogs and things like that, they all get Penn hips that are done.
Can we go back to the x-rays? Just
sure.
For a long time, in the early part of my career, I worked at Angel Animal Medical Center in the radiology department. And so we saw a tremendous amount of dogs for, you know, for OFAs and so forth. And I have to say that I'm a little confused sometimes because sometimes I have patients that come in and we x-ray them and they've walked in and they seem not too bad. They're pretty stable. And radiographically, their lips, their hips look horrible. And you're like, oh my God, this doesn't match the clinical, you know, what I'm seeing. And sometimes I have dogs that have radiographically mild hip dysplasia, but they're quite painful. And so sometimes the radiographs doesn't necessarily match how the dog is feeling. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's pretty classic. You know, that there's always a delay of what you're going to see on radiographs to usually the clinical signs, you know, by the time the changes start to occur with that. And it's not taking into account also the soft tissue discomfort. But really what we're all taught is that radiographs can show you that there's something going on there, right? That there's bony changes, it's not subluxated. And so this is classic. So the hideous hips that you'll see, you're like, oh my God, there's so much arthritis in there. Those dogs are really there because they're lame because they've torn their cranial cruciate ligament. And it's not their hips. So that's one thing as veterinarians too, is that just because it looks bad doesn't mean that that's the source of all the discomfort, okay, but that there's a lot of pathology that's going on there. But that is very classic, bad looking hips, but it's their knee that's causing the problems. And then you can have a dog that has mild changes or hardly any, but they're very uncomfortable. And so that has a lot to do with, I think, the soft tissue and you know, if they're younger, their hip is still kind of bouncing around more, but it takes time for those radiographic changes to be seen. So again, some of these dogs, you know, that may get an OFA good at 2 years of age, and let's say, oh, okay, that's great, and you're breeding them. Well, what are their hips look like at 7 or 10 years of age? Because what if they stayed thin and they were able to swim every day and go hiking? So they were in great shape, right? And they had great muscle tone. That's those environmental factors that can mask really the amount of laxity that is in those hips and their clinical signs. Because maybe you have the litter mate who's, you know, both came from good parents, but this one's more overweight, not in shape, but really in the line, they had more laxity that was actually there for that. So there is a huge difference in your screening programs between the pen hip and OFA. The OFA, another difference is that the OFA doesn't require you to send in the film. So if I have a dog that doesn't have good hips, well, I'm not going to spend the $30 to send it in, right?
Right.
Whereas pen hip, as a certified veterinarian, you have to take a course and do that. You have to submit the hips and your films, and the dogs have to be sedated because, again, we don't, there are some, you know, maybe not ideal breeders that like, no, I want my dog awake because I know they're going to tense up and make the hips look tighter. And then your database, the way the pen hip will compare it is that it will do it to the overall breed. But if you have a Labrador or German Shepherd, they're going to compare your dogs. They'll give you the average of the German Shepherd's, you know, DIs of that data grade. So if there's 10,000 German Shepherds, they're going to say, well, the average DI is like 0.4 and your dog had a, you know, 0.28, he's going to be a great breeding dog for hip dysplasia because he has really tight hips, versus, oh, my dog's a 0.8. So 80% of his hips is luxated. He would not be ideal. It doesn't mean that if you have a 0.8 that you're definitively going to have, you know, the worst looking hips and be clinical. It's kind of like your cholesterol level. The higher it is, the more likely you might have a heart attack or do something. So it's a risk factor. So maybe you're going to do things such as, let's make sure he stays lean. Let's maybe put him on, you know, like Dosequin hip supplements. Let's make sure that he's doing, you know, that, okay, he should not be an agility dog, but more swimming and, you know, low to moderate impact activity. So knowing kind of your dog's hip status, especially if you have a breed of dog where it's prevalent, you know, such as German Shepherds, you know, St. Bernards, Rotties, Newfoundlands, a lot of the large breed dogs, large and giant breed dogs, then it would be, you know, be smart to know what your dog's hip status is.
So let me ask you this. There are other causes of hip arthritis, correct? So correct. If your dog is aging and they get arthritis, it doesn't mean, you know, conversely or whatever, oh my gosh, they must have hip dysplasia and my vet didn't tell me. I had no idea. This is one of the causes of hip arthritis or degenerative joint disease.
Correct. So the caveat with that is, in general, hip dysplasia is bilateral. So it occurs in both hips. You might have one side that's affected more than the other, but you will see changes in both hips.
Okay.
In general, dogs with good hips and overall don't get the wear and tear arthritis that we all get as we've gotten older, right? Because they don't live till 50, 60 years of age. So if you have a greyhound, even if they were on the racetrack and they have great tight hips, at 14, their hips are still pristine. They don't have the wear and tear. So if I see a dog, you know, an older dog, and it has both hips that have OA, and it's a German Shepherd or a Golden or something like that, odds are it's due to hip dysplasia. If it's truly just one side, then more than likely there was trauma to that hip, or did they have another developmental orthopedic disease, such as like a cartilage issue, like what's called an OCD, an osteochondrosis portion, where as they're growing, which is also genetic, they get a soft spot in their cartilage that basically creates arthritis in a joint. So it's, you know, dogs, they don't really get the wear and tear. You know, out in Africa, you're not seeing the lions and cheetahs. They get older. Oh, I'm stiff, unless they've had trauma to it, that, you know, they should still have pretty clean hips, even at an older age.
I want to x-ray a lion's hips.
That would be, I know, huh?
Under sedation.
Yeah, amazing.
But, you know, I mean, if you just look at the greyhounds, you know, amazing musculature and stuff, and they have super tight hips, they still have great hips that 10, 11, 12 years of age. They may have something else like bone cancer, but they're not, you right. know, having arthritis in them.
And I think this is a good time to just reinforce that, you know, we need to take our pets to the veterinarian, because there is so much involved. You know, don't go to the internet and, you know, oh, it must be this, or my neighbor said my dog has that. Hopefully you can hear Dr. Powers stating that there's so much involved, not just the x-rays, but also the breeds, the clinical exam, what you tell the veterinarian in terms of the dog's daily life. It all paints a picture that leads to an accurate diagnosis. And without an accurate diagnosis, the your pet can't be treated as well as it might be. So no guessing out there.
Yeah.
To the vet.
Yeah, that's a perfect summary of it. And that happens a lot. You know, I think one other key thing is, when you have a young, you know, puppy and they come up lame, you need to have your vet take a look at that dog, because that's when a lot of the growth plates, and you can have growth plate fractures, especially what we call capital physeal fractures. So the cap on the head of the femur. You know, dog jumped off the puppy jumped off the bed or jumped down or something like that. And that would be something where that was trauma. And then later the dog isn't still, the puppy isn't doing well. And you see that, oh, that hip doesn't look right. So it is really important to have a diagnosis. And then the opposite goes for when they're older. You know, most dogs with hip dysplasia and hip arthritis, you can manage them. They're not going to all of a sudden come up lame in just one leg. And if they right. do, even if they have ugly looking hips, odds are it's probably the cruciate or something else that's going on. Doesn't mean it can't be, but if you're a betting person, you'd be like, oh, let's make sure there isn't a cruciate tear there, or they have a bulging disc and, right. you know, things like that. So it's important to have a diagnosis and not just blame everything on the hips either.
And I think that's an excellent point you just made, that it's not a sudden thing. This tends to be, you know, again, whatever genetics, you know, predispose them to some issues that lead to arthritis. And this is a gradual wear and tear kind of syndrome. And so, you know, if your dog is suddenly lame, then, you know, the odds are, like you said, as a betting person, it might be something else. Mm. So let's kind of jump into, you've alluded to ways that we can treat or manage hip dysplasia. I know some of it is some surgical options that are out there. Others are, you know, a multimodal approach, which you mentioned earlier. Can you kind of summarize what are the most viable options? Because again, I think a lot of people are going to the internet and, you know, getting supplements and things that may or may not be beneficial. And we want to provide very good information for our listeners.
Yeah. So, you know, when we divide it out, but if we just kind of first start with the kind of conservative or medical management, there's also, you know, the long-term portion of the adult dog and then the young dog. So in the young dog, they might be fine. And then from 8 months to a year or so, they might be, oh, my hips are really bothering them, you know, because they're kind of going through that. And if you can manage them through that, then they become that dog that, okay, is chronic, and you do the things of keeping them lean. So body weight, body weight, body weight. The supplements, you know, that's a hard thing. There's a gazillion things that are out there. It also goes back to what we call evidence-based medicine, right? Mm-hmm. You can have an opinion about something, but that doesn't mean it's factual. And so the best, you know, studies and things like that are what we call, you know, double-blinded placebo control, where you have two groups and one group gets the supplement and the other doesn't get anything. And then after a certain amount of time, you switch them and to see if it really works. For that, there's been a lot of research in the human side too, looking at the glucosamine chondroitin sulfate. And to be honest with you, in the end, there one isn't a lot of veterinary studies. I mean, it's the most out of the supplement groups, but still compared to the human side, it's significantly less. And there's probably minimal benefit, right, to it. But I tend to think of managing these guys like, think of it as a pie. So 50% of the pie for me is body weight and being really strict about that they are the appropriate weight. Mm-hmm. The other 50% are going to be things like, let's say, glucosamine chondroitin sulfate. Maybe that helps 2% or 20%, but that's another little slice. Fish oil or the omega-3 fatty acids have been shown to help reduce inflammation. So they're very important in helping reduce inflammation, because that's what arthritis, that's what's going on, and that's what's continuing to cause the, you know, the degradation of the joint or those inflammatory mediators. So being on the correct fish oil, and I tend to go to companies that have been around, let's say, longer than 10 years and have done at least some research on it. And one of my quote you know, companies that I trust is Nutramax, which makes Wellactin, which is a type of fish oil that you can get because they've done research where the other places might not. And there's a lot of testimonials. So I think that's important. And that would be another slice of that pie. Is that helping 10% or 20%? But I think it definitely has been shown the Purina JM, which is their joint mobility line, is a really good source of it. And they've done a recent study that came out from Wendy Baltzer. She's in Australia right now, but it looked at dogs post TPLOs that had cruciate tears. And basically, it showed a significant reduction in the amount of arthritis that had developed. And what we call when you cut the bone to do a TPLO, a lot of times at the 9-week mark where we do our, you know, recheck to say, hey, the dog looks great and, you know, hopefully going back to normal activity, you could still see a little bit of the osteotomy line, meaning that they were clinically healed, but because they reduced a lot of the inflammation radiographically, it just wasn't fully calcified yet. So it wasn't a bad thing, but it, you know, that's another option. So that's important. I think the omega-3 fatty acids, Dasaquin is another joint supplement that has, you know, avocado, soybean, and MSN in it. And again, there's only a few studies that maybe show that, oh, there's a little bit of benefit, but again, it's made by a company that at least has done some research to show. So those are all kind of those slices of pie that I say, hey, if we get 10% or 5% or 25% from each of those, that's a good thing, right? It's another tool in the toolbox. What's really popular you hear about these days, right, is PRP or platelet-rich plasma or stem cells, hyaluronic acid. So with the hyaluronic acid or the HA, and I do put that in, you know, at the end of all my knee surgeries and such, it's another supplement that helps kind of reduce some of the inflammation in the joint and provides the cartilage that's still good, you know, healthy stuff or building blocks to try to keep that cartilage to stay healthy. And it's an easy thing to do, and it's generally not as expensive as like your stem cells and platelet-rich plasma. The whole regenerative medicine, there's still a lot of unknown answers. It's very dependent on the type of machine that you use to get your platelet-rich plasma. It's been shown because when you look at these PRP systems, the goal is to get more platelets because they have these growth factors, again, to help with the overall joint health. And you try to reduce the amount of red blood cells and white blood cells. And it wasn't until recently when Sam Franklin did a study where he looked at five different machines because they would have different percentages of those. So it is important in the machine, but we still can't say in the few little studies out there that, oh, wow, these are great. And, you know, they're the best thing since sliced bread. We still can't tell you, you know, how many times does the dog need to do it? Do you need to kind of like do it once a month for 3 months, or can you do it once a year? The studies have shown some benefit in reducing inflammation in arthritic dogs. In the tendons, it hasn't, you know, declared itself yet, but there's just so much unknowns out there that I think it is something that's going to be beneficial, but we don't have the evidence-based medicine to say, oh yeah, this is perfect. Again, there is no one thing, whether it's medical treatment or surgery, that is going to cure arthritis. So we need to manage it.
Let me talk about the cherry on your pie, Dr. Powers. I like what you're saying. I think that it all makes sense, but also, and I know you're going to get to this, but As part of the multimodal approach, I think rehabilitation is fantastic, you know, and not just because I'm a rehabilitator, but also because we do get results. But I think it would be great if we could get these dogs that are diagnosed with hip dysplasia referred to rehabilitation. And if you listen to some of our other shows that Chris and I have done, we're always talking about things about not only changing or modifying the dog's environment, but things like the importance of traction, the importance of raising your dog bowls, the importance of not slipping, splaying, the importance of harnesses and mobility aids and things like that. So, you know, we have modalities to help these dogs gain, you know, more strength, or whether they're getting ready for surgery or we're doing medical management, but also we can guide these owners in things like, how do we modify our homes to accommodate these dogs and their hip dysplasia?
Yeah, that's a huge point. And I'm a big proponent of it. You know, I was just on the phone with a client saying, hey, you need to do rehab because like your dog's hip, because if anything, right, when you have these loose hips, all their hip, you know, adductors, their pectineus, all their sartor, all these muscles in that area get tight. Like I have a bad back and being out of shape right now, my hip flexors are killing me, right?
Right.
So these dogs are being also compensatory, throwing their weight, you know, forward or to the opposite front leg. And generally what I say is like, we're going to do all this stuff, but I also want you to go to do rehab to learn how to do all the things that you talked about, you know, the home environment, but gaining flexibility, right? You know, their hamstrings are tight and stuff. And learning how to gain a good core. You know, we talk about core in humans, but it's the same thing for dogs. Out on the agility course, I see a lot of dogs that don't have a strong core and they're flipping out their back legs. And, you know, then they get a lot of disc issues because there isn't that control of it. So I do think, yes, rehab is important. I tell people they should go. And then they learn from you guys a program that's lifelong for these dogs. So I think it's great. And especially if we're talking about the activity level, you know, the swimming, if they have access to that, or underwater treadmill, and, you know, you're reducing the amount of stress that are on those joints. So it's a win-win all the way around. And again, hence multimodal. It's not a one-shot deal and one thing does everything, but it's, you know, works together.
Well, and I was going to say too, that it is a lifelong management thing. So in terms of rehab, you know, sometimes I think, you know, thinking about it like prehab. So if you know that your animal has these lax hips at a young age, there are so many things we can do to prevent the progression of the arthritis. We can slow down the progression, but also mitigate the severity by doing all the things we just mentioned. Appropriate activities, you know, low impact versus risky high impact activities with lots of, you know, twisting and so forth. We can work on that strength. We can ensure that they have full range of motion and they don't get tight in those muscles and then, you know, cause issues in other areas of their body. But then on the flip side, you know, checking in with your rehabber throughout your dog's lifetime, because things change. And so now they have arthritis. And for us, for Kathy and me, you know, treatment of arthritis is probably the biggest piece of our rehab pie in terms of, you know, what we see. As a result of whatever may be going on orthopedically that you treat, Dr. Power. So, you know, the cruciate ligament tears and that have surgery and, you know, the hip dysplasia and elbow issues and so forth. So, you know, a lot of it ends up in arthritic changes. And that, I think, it's certainly like in the top 5 or 6 of all reasons that pet owners bring their animals to the vet is because of some sort of arthritic condition, resulting in mobility issues and pain and reduced quality of life. So,
yeah, totally agree. Totally agree.
And Dr. Powers, you are also a certified canine rehabilitation person.
That's right.
So you cover all angles as well.
Right. I'm not as good as you guys probably, but no, all my discharges talk about going to rehab. I'm a huge proponent of it. And, you know, all the performance dogs, I'm like, you need to be on a maintenance program and learn the exercises that are important. And it, you know, it isn't all about one modality either. You know, it isn't all about the laser, or it isn't all about, oh, they have an underwater treadmill. It's
right.
You know, what they're seeing you guys for, and what I rely on you too, is your hands and putting, you know, hey, you know,
amen.
You know, like I'm like, look, you're a little tight here. And then, you know, I'll have you guys tell me that, oh, you know, the Sartorius was a little bit tight there, or I've seen it. And, you know, like Chris, having the human side, you just can't, you know, you just can't beat that. And seeing the things. And I think that's what I tell people too, that are new to rehab, that, you know, there's a lot more to it that you have a cruciate. You should do these exercises. It really is seeing the dog in total. And that's mm-hmm. what I tell people. They're like, yes, we're going to work on your cruciate, but your dog is also has no core, and we need to fix that. And, you know, so I think it's very important, and it's huge. Hence the reason I got certified, because I really believe in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wanting to understand it, you know, we want to understand, you know, your role as a surgeon and a veterinarian that makes these accurate diagnoses. And then, you know, I think it's important for the veterinary community to understand our role as rehabilitationists. So
the importance of seeking out someone who, doing rehabilitation, who's been trained.
Yeah.
Correct.
Not certified.
Not just your setup one on the corner that somebody got a swimming pool. You really need to seek out somebody who has their CCRT or their CCRP, somebody who's been trained specifically for rehab.
Yeah, I'm that is huge, because it isn't about, you know, there are some places that just want to promote the underwater treadmill, and it's not about that. It, you know, I always tell people too, I go, well, you've probably done physical therapy on yourself, like gone to for some injury. How many times were you in a pool or something? I'm not saying that, you know, that you shouldn't do that, but I really want to have your hands and your thoughts. And for me as a specialist, they're going to be seeing you a lot more as their activity increases. So you're going to be able to say, you know, hey, Powers, I saw him for this, and, you know, we were working on his hips, but now I'm noticing he's, you know, there's a little bit of knee pain now, and things are changing. And so I rely on, you know, you guys are my other set of hands, and I trust them to help, because things can change, right?
Yep. Yes.
So
should we touch just briefly on surgical options? Are there valid surgical treatment options for hip dysplasia, and when would you do those?
Yeah. So for surgery, really, there's probably the big three that you'll hear about are the total hip replacement, whether it's the triple pelvic osteotomy or the double pelvic osteotomy, and the FHO or the femoral head and neck osteectomy. Probably one in three are the most common. The triple pelvic osteotomy or the double is probably fallen out of favor, because no matter what, these are salvage procedures. Again, they're not going to cure or prevent the progression of arthritis. And so with the triple pelvic osteotomy, God, like maybe 12 years ago, we were doing them as much as we were doing cruciates, but they were still getting arthritis in those hips. And there were other complications, but the end result was they still had arthritis, and you're still having to manage them. So that is probably fallen out of favor for, you know, how popular it was, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago. The total hip replacement, you know, that is the one that, yes, you are biomechanically going to get a new hip, because there's a you know, you're putting an implant, just like if you or I were going to get a total hip, there's a brand new cup and there's a brand new ball, and it is a perfect, you know, stainless steel total hip. And so biomechanically, they do great. And 90% of them do well. There's about a 10% complication rate. And when those complications occur, it's a very long and expensive process that you could end up with multiple revisions, or in the end up with the FHO. It is more expensive. They're probably in that 6,000 plus range. If you're looking to do that, I would find someone who does a lot of them. I don't tend to do them because I've had more people want to do the conservative management and get good results with that. And for the amount of equipment, because it is expensive to have all that equipment, and you worry about infection and all sorts of things that are doing it, that I just didn't feel like I would be doing enough of them in a year to be, you know, the best at it. So I would just say the person that's doing them, you want someone who does a lot of total hips, and the majority, like I said, 90% of the time they'll do well. We tend to want to wait till their growth plate or they're kind of mature. So if we can get them when they're over a year, or if they're a giant breed dog, you know, over a year and a half, that's better than doing it while their growth plates are still, you know, developing, in that sense. The FHO is basically where you cut off that ball and the neck portion, and dogs do great with FHOs because it creates this false joint, you know? So it is the only orthopedic procedure where I'm saying after like the first week, you get that dog walking and doing rehab, and rehab is a key that they don't scar down tight, but they have a nice scar tissue, quote unquote, you know, joint. And dogs do really well. You can do it really in any size of dog, and you've gotten rid of that bone on bone pain for that. So that can be done at any time of their life. And so it's usually, you know, okay, they're not responding to conservative management. They're very uncomfortable. They're having a decreased quality of life. And even though you're doing maybe all the other things, you don't want to keep them. Our goal as veterinarians is not to keep every dog on drugs. You know what I mean? For that. So the FHO is a less expensive salvage procedure to get rid of the bone on bone pain. There is something that has been done in puppies. Usually you try to do it less than 20 weeks of age. It's called the juvenile pubic syntheodesis, or JPS. Again, that's probably not that popular. The way that works is that you have to get a pen hip done like at 16 weeks to know, like, okay, is my dog a 0.8? You know, he has really loose hips. So it would be worth having him get potentially a JPS, where you fuse the growth plate on the pelvis. You basically kind of cauterize it, so you damage the growth plate so that that area doesn't grow. And the goal of it is that it changes the pelvis so that you're increasing, ideally, the coverage of that ball. Again, because so many dogs do well with the conservative stuff, and it's not 100%, and you have to do it by a certain age and these things, there's not a high demand for it, or I would say a need to do it in that sense.
So I think we've covered a ton of information, and I just wanted to ask, I guess, in summary, is there any particular take-home message or pearl of information that you'd like to leave our audience with, or, you know, a particularly, you know, interesting case or aha moment, Dr. Powers?
I guess some of the big take-home messages, you know, with hip dysplasia that I have is, you know, testing for it. Doing pen hip is definitely better than the OFA. That having hip dysplasia is not a death sentence. Weight management is key, you know, for it. And I think there's a lot of things, and, you know, unfortunately there are a lot of overweight dogs, you know, probably 90% of what we see on a day are overweight. And I think that's something that we can control. I know it's hard for me to control to lose weight, but I can do it for my dogs.
Exactly.
I think a classic was when I was stationed at Fort Huachuca, there was what's called Command Row, and I was there in December. And so in just before Christmas, they have this thing where, you know, these are where all like the generals are, like all the high ranking officers are. And they would have a thing where, like at Fort Huachuca, it was General Custard's old house that they decorate, and you can go in and, you know, you walk through the houses to see this. And it's called Command Row. And I remember walking around, I saw this gorgeous golden retriever, and they had, you know, the red scarf around his neck. And he was just a sweetheart, good looking dog, just loving life sitting there, you know, and people were petting him. And I remember, like, I don't know, a couple weeks later, all of a sudden I'm seeing this dog, and it was the commander of the base, his wife, bringing it in. So it was like, oh boy, you know, like, don't want to mess this up. And she, you know, was basically a 3-year-old golden retriever, and it was a little overweight, and she's coming in, and basically I diagnosed it with hip dysplasia and some arthritis. And she's like, he used to, you know, run around the backyard and chase deer and everything like that, and now he really doesn't do that. So here I am, you know, a captain going, look, you need to have your dog lose weight. And, you know, we put him on fish oils and that stuff. I go, weight loss is huge. You know, you can come every 2 weeks into the clinic and weigh your dog, because dogs can lose a half a pound to a pound a week, healthy wise, right? So it shouldn't take, you know, years to get a few pounds off of. And the dog needed to really lose probably about 10 pounds. Well, she did it, and she comes in to the clinic, and she is sitting there. Oh my God, my dog is running, jumping, and playing. It's acting like it's 1 year old, and she's so happy. And I'm like, oh, thank God, you know, that this is working. Wasn't on any medications. And then I hear her out in the lobby, you know, with these other, you know, military people in the clinic, since we're on base, and she's just basically lecturing them on body weight. Don't let your dogs get fat. And I'm just like, okay, I have the base commander's wife telling all these enlisted people that they better not have fat dogs. I couldn't, you know, I like had the best advertisement right then and there. So that story always kind of sticks with me, because basically we just did, you know, at that time, we didn't have access to the rehab and stuff, but just the weight loss and the fish oil were got that dog started. And I think would do even better if we could have done the whole gamut too, you know. And I'm also a believer in, you know, acupuncture for chronic diseases is another thing, but there's a lot to do out there that doesn't require expensive surgeries to, you know, to do something, or necessarily stem cells to fix, because even if stem cells were great, if you put it into a fat dog, it's not going to be good.
Right. Well, I think that story, of course, is just wonderful.
It's great.
And I do think that people underestimate the significance of having an obese or even a slightly overweight animal, how much difference it can make. And, you know, so that story really says it all.
Really is about caloric restriction, whether you have a paralyzed dog or, you know, anything. And look, you know, knock on wood, I'm very happy to say, and I don't want to jinx myself, you know, Poachie, my oldest dog, he's 16, almost 16 and a half, you know, and he's still got a great body. And I think it's because he stayed thin and things like that. And also, you know, I do put him on like the BOSU ball and stuff and try to work on, you know, his isometric type of stuff to keep him strong. I think it's all key.
Mm-hmm. I was also going to say that, you know, you mentioned earlier about, you know, it's not, you know, you don't, I guess it's just a very powerful statement as well, that you as a board certified surgeon are not promoting surgery, because a lot of times, you know, I think people think if you have a hammer, the world's a nail, right? But right. If you're a good veterinarian, then you are able to see the bigger picture. You're not necessarily, you know, or unnecessarily prescribing drugs that could have potential side effects, or, you know, saying the dog needs surgery, that there are other avenues, especially in the case of arthritis, that are equally or even more important in terms of care for our pets, such as the weight loss.
Great.
You know, I think that Kathy and I would both love to have you again. You know, we great guests we like to have back. And so maybe we can talk about having you, you know, talk about another thing, maybe elbow dysplasia.
About elbow dysplasia.
Yeah.
Sure. Follow up.
So we will definitely be in touch. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
It was nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Bye.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed our show. Follow us on Facebook or on Instagram at Petability Podcast.
For more information about Kathy's books and living with blind dogs, please go to enableyourpet.com. Thank you, and please tune in next time.